From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in an elementary school where a couple dozen kids are working on tablets in their classroom. They are wearing headphones, looking intently at their screens. Their lesson is an interactive math game on the device, and it's doing a good job of keeping their attention. But is using a device the best way to deliver a classroom lesson? It's a question up for debate, especially when it intersects with conversations about screen time for children. The American Academy of Pediatrics released new screen time guidelines in 2016. It also released recommendations related to how to use media, what types of media kids should be exposed to and how often, and the role of parents when it comes to media use and devices. When we ask how much screen time is too much for kids, we're often thinking about screen time at home, whether it's TV, video games, social media. But what about screen time at school? An increasing number of schools are incorporating devices, technology into their lesson plans. Should that screen time factor into overall limits for children? Last year in Utah, an online-only preschool served around 10,000 students. Meanwhile, other schools are banning devices from their classrooms, and there's an uptick in the number of play-based schools, of course. So where is the balance? What is the role of teachers in helping kids find that balance when it comes to quality screen time? Our guest for this hour will help us answer that question, and we're going to talk about the impact of educational screen time. Joining us in studio, Tony Tepidino teaches entrepreneurship electives, among other things, and is a digital literacy teacher at Allendale Columbia School. Tony, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us is Kristen Rorapaw, who's president of the Allendale Columbia Schools Parents Association. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And in a moment, we'll welcome Steve Cook. Dr. Cook is an associate professor of pediatrics at Golisano Children's Hospital for a bit of both the parent and the medical perspective on this. There's a lot of ongoing research on this, and I guess I'm going to start with Kristen and say, you know, as a parent who I'm sure, like me, you're always thinking about appropriate screen time, balance. How do you view screen time as it relates to schools and whether, quote unquote, it counts for us to be sort of banking and counting?
It's a balancing act. I mean, utilizing the technology is the way students expect to learn nowadays. You know, they want to have instant access to knowledge. And having that in the classroom provides that. It's not the days of when teachers just stood in front of the classroom reciting the knowledge that the teacher had to the students. Students wanted to be interactive. They wanted to be engaging and fun, and that helps them learn more. And I think, you know, having that technology in the classroom can provide that learning experience for the students. Not all students learn the same way. So, you know, having different ways of learning can help those students retain the knowledge better. We found with our child, you know, he doesn't enjoy reading as much, but over the summer he would have to read books for school. And if I downloaded the Kindle version and the audiobook, he got it two different ways. So, you know, he's got two screens there in front of him, but he was learning the knowledge. His brain was receiving it two different ways, and he would retain the knowledge more. So I think it can be utilized in beneficial ways.
How old is he?
He is 14.
14. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there are no more generations who are going to grow up without technology centrally involved in their lives. We were sort of the crossover generation that we kind of grew up generally without it, or at least without it as a ubiquitous form of communication. And now it's everywhere. And so, you know, we can't avoid that. So, Tony, give me a sense, generally speaking, then we'll get more specific about how your school and how you view technology as an aid to teaching lessons and being in the classroom.
Well, I think the most important part is we really have to view technology as a tool, and it's pervasive, as you were saying. And the minute we sort of stifle that or limit that in school, I mean, I think our goal really is to prepare kids for this world they're going to inherit, and the world is full of technology. I think the real question is how we're using it and what is our intention around that usage. So we try to be really thoughtful about the way we're expecting kids to use technology, not mindlessly using it, trying to be really thoughtful and create really good scenarios for the usage and introduction of technology in school.
How often are kids at Allendale Columbia using screens for lessons?
Well, it really depends on the teacher, but it's every day. And again, it varies classroom to classroom. It depends on the content. It depends on the type of lesson that they're involved in. You know, there's a class that I teach where we use technology as a way to supplement and to get certain information or to distribute information. But a lot of the class is discussion-based, so we don't really use the tech, and I manage it differently. Some teachers are still using things like PowerPoints to present information to students. We use a learning management system where all the students can access all of their coursework, assignments, and most of the things that they would need to have during the day. So the answer is it does vary dependent on the need. But the expectation is that there is technology used basically in every classroom, but for very specific purposes.
All right. I want to bring in Dr. Steve Cook, who is an associate professor of pediatrics at Golisano Children's Hospital and no stranger to the parenting challenges that we all face. Fair enough, Dr.
Oh, you got that right.
So on the subject of screen time, generally speaking, I admit, and this is maybe a little embarrassing to say, but, you know, today is my son's 7th birthday. And yes, I mean, like, as kids, you know, grow up, screens are out there. I think of the challenge of screen time generally as what happens in his life after school. And until we were talking to the folks from Allendale and we're kind of having this conversation about that, I admit, like, I kind of wasn't counting that chunk of time when he's in school. I'm thinking, well, you know, he's done with school. What are we doing? Are we going to go play basketball? Does he want to go outside? Does he want to do something on a screen? And how much, when do we set the limits? Not thinking, what has he done all day already? How much do we need to be thinking about that?
I think we need to be thinking about it a lot and logically. I mean, if they are on a screen for assignments and doing, you know, classwork or reading or projects, then it's a bit different. The gray area or blurry area is the fact is they can be doing two things on a screen at once. Even though your mind technically can't multitask, we think we can. So as a kid gets older, they might be sitting there, I'm doing my homework, but in the side screen they got a video playing and they flip it back and forth between that. Or they have a chat box open, or they have their phone with their group chat going and they're doing an assignment. So, you know, that type of behavior is one of the harms, not so much of screens, but just of the overstimulation of the brain. Kids don't learn how to focus and function properly. The fact is that the delivery vehicle of that happens to be computers, tablets, and phones. So it's very difficult to tease it out, but it's very important to ask that question. And it's a developmentally appropriate question. The simple question we get sometimes is, when can a kid get a phone? And I tell parents, you know, the rule we've used or we try to explain to parents is wait till 8. And they're like, 8 years old? I'm like, no, 8th grade. And they look at me like, what? And the sad part is the data is coming out. Toddlers, 2-year-olds, looking at their exposure to a smartphone or a tablet, we are seeing language delays in some of those kids with more or higher levels of exposure. And the parents are thinking, well, they're just watching videos. Well, it may not be that the videos themselves are bad, but what are they not doing? And it's, you know, so it's not always, is this the harm? It's where the benefit is not there. So it's not sitting on the lap reading a book. It's not reading books in general. So that is a very difficult thing that, again, looking at very early in life, we have to bring that up. So,
So Dr. Cook, among our guests here, has given us a lot to think about, because there's a lot of layers to this. It's not just screen time, good, bad, and we're going to talk about that, because I know Allendale is very sensitive to making sure that it's productive, it's quality instruction. We'll talk about how they do that. We'll talk about how they do that without letting technology distract. Having taught a college course myself, you can always tell. And Professor Leah Stacey always says this. Students think that, well, you can't tell. The teacher or professor can't tell when you're on their phone. They can tell. But the question is, can we create technology, you know, screen time in class that doesn't distract, that just focuses on the lesson and the lesson alone? And parents and listeners, if you've got thoughts to share on this as we talk screen time, limits, and factoring school screen time, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I've already got some of your emails, and you can send more, connections@WXXI.org. Dr. Cook, is there a raw number per day based on year that we want to be saying, hey, this should be the cutoff? It's 30 minutes, it's 60 minutes, it's 90 minutes, whatever it is.
So I wish
you're almost. I want people to see you almost rolling your eyes, because you know what your eyes tell me? Ugh, I knew you were going to ask me. Everyone always asks that, and it's more complicated than that.
Exactly. It's like the question, what's the one thing you could do to prevent this problem? Well, the one thing I would do is stop making people ask or think there's one thing you can do.
Yeah.
So we really will say no screen time under two, with the exception of FaceTiming grandma and grandpa who live in our state. You know, so that's like a phone call. And family's like, what? And I'm like, yeah, you realize that children never had screens and such access to them at such a young age. As kids start getting a little bit, you know, older, you get past two or three and they get a little more interactive, then, you know, maybe an hour or two a day. There was a national study about 4 or 5 years ago, and it's probably totally outdated, but estimated screen time for an adolescent, all screens, was 7 hours a day. But that incorporates some of their education time, not just social time or games or whatever. So, you know, I really try to push families to do more and more and set it back and to role model it. And I've used this example, if people hate me, I'm sorry, hate me. It's like secondhand smoke. You wouldn't smoke in front of your toddler or your infant or your kid. Don't use your phone for work or play or whatever in front of your kid a lot and try not to make them think that they shouldn't do it either. I mean, it's really ridiculous. And it's sad because it is so invasive in our society, but we really have to step back and think about it.
All right, so model, and without putting a raw number, that 7 hour average seemed excessive to you?
That's excessive. So, you know, you have an adolescent, if they have 2 or 3 hours a day in school, maybe it's 2 or 3 hours at night. And the nice thing is I have a phone from a company that rhymes with Snapple, not to endorse a product, but it has a screen time function that's programmed in now. And I found it out before my daughters did, my two teenagers, and they did not like that because I programmed in the shutdown. And so it turns off at 10 p.m., but you can limit that the phone is still on or texting is on or find me. And then you can put limits within that time. You know, it turns on at 8 a.m., but if they've been giving me trouble in the morning, maybe it doesn't turn on until 3 p.m. And so they only have so many hours of either specific game or social media or stuff like that. So there's some tools that can help us, but we have to be willing to live by those rules ourselves.
All right, before we get to some of your feedback, Kristen, you're as the parent of a 14-year-old, in a world with Fortnite and everything else crashing in around us here and a lot of these polls here, how do you do you set any raw limits or how do you create sort of limits?
I mean, we don't specify you can only be on the computer for 2 hours this evening. I mean, right. We understand he's going to be on it during the day doing work. You know, I hate to say the phrase necessary evil, but it is. He's going to be on it during the day. At the same time, he enjoys getting online with his friends when they game together after he's done with his homework. That's how kids interact nowadays. That's, you know, if we tell him no gaming, he's going to miss out on socializing with them. And that's something that he needs to develop as well. He can't just be reclusive with no computer, no access to his friends. But we do our best to limit extended game time on the computer. You know, hey, it's time to get up now. Let's go walk the dog. Let's go out and do something together. Let's go skiing this afternoon. You know, trying to get other things in to balance it. You know, there was a time when our older son was sucked into gaming and, you know, and then he phased out of it. And, you know, I would see him watching, they would watch people playing other games.
Yeah. Yeah.
On television.
On YouTube, and too. It's amazing.
Oh, my gosh. I didn't understand it.
I still don't.
It took them repeatedly telling me that they're watching other people play games so they can learn to be better. They're using it as a skill, learning new strategies. How can I, you know, interact with my friends on this game to become better? And that's what they were learning. It's the same as if they would go outside and practice lacrosse or practice baseball. It was just another tool. It's the same as if I go on YouTube to learn a new stitch for knitting. I'm doing the same thing. So, you know, but it's still this balancing act. I mean, we told them when they were in middle school, you are playing a sport after school. You're not just coming home and plopping down in front of the computer. You're going to interact with your friends. You're going to learn a new sport. And
yeah,
that helps limit.
You talk about interact with your friend in sports. You know, I take the point that you're concerned that they want to be gaming because that's where the social world is. Is that exclusively? Or do you feel like if you took that away entirely, that would be too injurious to a social life for a teenager?
I do for my younger one because he really doesn't engage in social media. That's how he interacts with his friends. I mean, especially at Allendale Columbia because the kids live all over the city. You know, he doesn't have as many just neighborhood friends that he goes to school with. So it's much easier for them to engage with each other after school because kids are on the other side of the city, miles and miles away, that he's not going to be able to get together with at 9 o'clock at night when he's done with his homework.
So, Tony, knowing the concerns parents have when the kids are in their care, when they're in your care, how do you make sure that the lessons are effective, that if we're going to use technology, it's because it's the best way to teach here, and it's not going to be something that they could also find a way to get themselves distracted by?
That's a great question, and I think that has a lot to do with how the devices are managed in the classroom, and that is a hurdle for a lot of teachers. So, and I think like Dr. Cook was saying too, the real interesting thing is this issue of divided attention, and it's really hard to really navigate that. I mean, I don't really have a clear answer for you on that. It's a really difficult space. I think one of the things we try to do, at least I try to do in my classroom, is to create classroom norms around technology usage, in what that looks like, what that sounds like in the classroom. You know, don't walk in and have your device out unless there's an intended purpose for that. So I think the more conversations that we can have around appropriate use of the devices in the classroom, and then also, like Dr. Cook said, I completely agree about modeling. You know, I do my best to model appropriate use. I don't have my phone out in the room. You know, I use my computer as a way to guide lessons. And I think the more teachers that we can talk to and like be overt about what they expect from students in the room and the impact that it has on attention is way too important of an issue, because again, like, you can't multitask, and that's something that kids really don't quite, I don't know if they don't understand or they just don't care, because we do see a lot of that still in lounges or in different places where I'm writing an essay and they have another device out that's like showing something on the screen. So it's a conversation and it's modeling.
So before we jump to your phone calls, one, to be fair to Tony here, we're talking about the pitfalls here, but you wouldn't use it if you didn't also see the benefits.
Oh, yeah.
Where do you see it?
Well, I mean, again, it's going back to that whole idea of like, these kids are going to walk out into the world and they're going to have access to a device. And if we don't give them a place to really experiment with using that appropriately and to feel the consequences of the decisions that they're making, they're going to be let loose when they move out of the protection of our households and get to college, and they're not going to have any schema at all for how to navigate those spaces. So if we can't, you know, model, work with, have conversations around the appropriate use of those things, they're going to walk out into a world with no understanding of what this is doing to them, why it's, how it's diverting their attention, the impact it's having on their ability to think deeply and thoughtfully and to make decisions. So I think it's our opportunity in schools to really, truly give them the tools they need to understand what these things do, but to also understand, right, it's a great, powerful tool, right? How can we utilize that in a really appropriate way? And then, you know, it's too important. And I do find it interesting, too, that schools, in a lot of cases, and I don't want to generalize too much here, but, you know, the only place they can't have their phone to use to answer questions is a classroom. But, like, we use our phones everywhere all the time to answer, like, the most simple, mundane questions. So it's, again, it's like, what are we doing with these devices, and how could we leverage that power really appropriately and with intention?
And so for schools that are choosing to be essentially close to technology-free or at least screen-free, you think that's too much?
Well,
just because of the world, the realistic world that of adulthood they're headed for?
I think if you're teaching kids to make good decisions in whatever capacity and there's intention around that, I think there's an opportunity for people to make good decisions, period. You're understanding yourself. You're understanding the impacts that it's going to have. So I don't want to judge the people that choose to make the decisions to not have their kids in schools where technology is pervasive. I think that's a choice you're making. I think you're making the best decision you can with the understanding and the impact that you want to have on your child. I like to think we're really doing a better job of being more thoughtful and overt about the access that we're giving kids and the intention that we have as a school and as a community to provide that access. But I think it's a parental choice, and I think it's a difficult one. And I wouldn't want to say one's right or wrong. I think it's a very tough place to navigate as a parent and as a teacher.
You want to add to that, Dr. Cook?
It is extremely difficult. And you know, from a health standpoint, you know, we look at, you know, we're going to try a new medicine. We think it's helpful. Is it beneficial for this disease? We research it. We test it. Does it work? And is it safe? We haven't done that with technology. And so things you're describing, kids have done for years. So kids go home and they turn on the radio and they're doing their homework with the radio on. And maybe they call a friend on a phone. the problem is that all this stuff is happening so much more rapidly. And we know computer time can double, but human brain processing time doesn't double like that. And so we are coming to a crossroads. I mean, there's actually data that shows we're biologically at this crossroads where technology and these other things are increasing in capacity and speed much faster than we can adapt. So it's not entirely different, but it has surpassed us. And we have to look at it because, you know, it's typical of the intro that, you know, if the people who developed these tools didn't allow their kids to have them, you know, that should tell you something. They know that something is there that's dangerous, whether it's the same thing we're worried about now, or is it the fact that, you know, they're just out in a web that can have predators disguised as children or vice versa. You know, they were cautious about it. And the reality is that we've never had any of these devices that we think are helpful check to see, are they really helpful? Or do we think they're just helpful? So I would really want to know, do data management systems in the classroom really improve efficiency and speed, or is it perception? Do the kids really do better by some objective type of measure or not? Because you're soaking lots of dollars into those resources. As a taxpayer with kids in public schools, you know, we have to wonder about this. I go into a school, every room's got a smart board. I'm in a university and we have lots of teaching for residents and students and stuff, and I don't have nearly as many smart boards around and stuff. So someone's paying for that. Are we really having a benefit, and is there a potential harm? And technology in many facets has done this. I mean, there's a great study that just came out on the Apple Watch. Huge, huge heart study. People portraying the Apple Watch as a great way to monitor the heart and potentially a dangerous arrhythmia called AFib. Well, guess what? It failed. It did horrible. It identified very few cases of AFib correctly, and it was found to miss a number of those. But Apple and the device maker said, we can do this and roll it out, and this will be great for your employees to monitor their health conditions, insurance companies. You know, people are signing on to it, and we've not put it through the rigorous testing that we put, you know, other, you know, medications. And it's maybe a narrow example, but it's the reality is that millions of dollars are soaked into these devices, whether it's in the education side, on the health side, or other areas. I mean,
so change has happened fast in terms of the ubiquity of technology. The research isn't always caught up to it. Fair?
Definitely not caught up to it. Very fair. Yep.
Okay. You go ahead,
yeah,
Tom.
And I'd like to add just a little bit to that, because I think that's all. Those are all really good points too. And you know, there's a researcher named Cal Newport who's done a ton of research on the inattention, the what the devices do to your attention, and he's a really fascinating guy to research and to do a little. To listen to some of the information he has. He's great at talking about the distractibility of the device and what that has actually done to your ability to deeply think and process cognitively. And then one of the other pieces of this that I think is really missing in the conversation is schools haven't really adapted to meet the needs, not only of the kids, but the way the technology is utilized. So I think it's very fair to say that we probably as a system haven't, I would firmly believe this, that the system hasn't adapted to not only to the needs of the students, but to the way that the technology could impact the classroom. So it's a couple of pieces that are really missing in this conversation. And there's a lot of reasons why, you know, but that's maybe a conversation for a whole different show.
All right, let's get some feedback from listeners. Leslie in Brighton is first. Go ahead, Leslie.
Hi. I don't understand why everyone feels the need to get their child a smartphone. I have an eighth grader. We decided last year to get her a flip phone so she could communicate with us and text. And there's always with teenagers the fear of being left out. She does have an iPad at home that she can group text with her friends. But that works fine. I don't see the need for children to have the internet in their pocket. But that decision was still taken away from us when she entered eighth grade because all the eighth graders receive tablets in her school with full access to the internet, and they're on their screens the entire day, and then for most of the evening doing her homework. And, you know, I don't think we can compare teenager brains to adult brains when someone was just saying we use our phones to look up things, so, you know, the kids should be able to use this tool, but our kids' brains are still developing. And I find I'm more distractible because of my technology. I see her not being able to focus as well on her homework and it taking longer. You know, it's right there to click over. You can click over easily and look at this. She tells me in school kids are on their tablets looking at YouTube videos or online shopping. I just, And I have a friend who's a college professor who said he can't stand the technology in the classroom. He's forbidden laptops in the classroom because the kids now in college have the attention span of a flea. So, you know, I'm just curious what people think about. Like, I see technology being used in the school just for the sake of using technology. There are awesome projects that they have done, and that's great. And I think it's a powerful tool, but I think that everything does not have to be done on the tablet. I think it's just using it for the sake of using it at this point.
Well, Leslie, so
that's the end of my comment.
Yeah, well, thank you, Leslie. I appreciate that. And I feel the passion of a parent there. And that's a little bit we were talking about with Tony, is making sure that if you're going to use technology in a lesson, that it bolsters and enhances the lesson as opposed to it's just a different way to do a lesson. Fair, right?
Right. Technology is a replacement tool. I mean, if there's some understand, I do understand why that does happen. But yeah, I mean, that's sort of a poor use of the power of technology, just as a replacement for a whiteboard or a smartboard.
And I wonder also, you know, turn to Kristen Rorpoff for this. You know, you've got a 14-year-old as your younger son, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, Leslie's concerned that college students don't have attention spans anymore, which I don't know if it's been studied, but I do understand the idea. I mean, look, we have less, the adults, the collective we, have less of an attention span than the generation of voters that watched the Lincoln-Douglas debates. I mean, the world has changed. I take that point. Do you worry about that with your kids, though, in terms of attention span getting so short that it could affect college preparation?
I do. I mean, our other son is a freshman in college. So between the two of them, and some of it depends on the child itself. Our kids are very different from each other. The older one, yeah, his attention span is much less. He was the one that was more on his phone, and constantly checking on social media, doing that, where the other one really does not. He'll put his phone away while he's doing his homework and not be distracted by it, where the older one would. And there was one evening where, you know, my older son is doing his homework. He's got his headphones on with his music. His phone is also there with the group chat going. And I went in, and he's trying to do his homework, and every 15 seconds I'm calling his name and interrupting him and interrupting constantly. And he's like, stop. I'm like, this is exactly what your phone is doing to you as you're trying to do your homework. You can't get a consistent thought process going. You know, and that opened his eyes to him. But I do think it does depend on the child itself, you know, and what their nature is. But I don't know. It's really hard because there's such peer pressure out there for the kids to be engaged socially that, you know, it's hard to, I don't know, it's hard to draw the line.
It's hard to be a parent.
Yeah.
When it comes to school choices here, there's independent schools and there are some public schools that are strictly limiting or eliminating screen time during the school day. Would you ever want your child to be at a school that had no screen time during the day?
Well, our older son did go to public school, and there were classrooms that he was in where the phones had to go into a holder or
yep.
a basket,
yep.
and they were not allowed to have them. And I think that's fine. You know, if they're not using their phone for research during the class, they really shouldn't be on it. I'm fine with that. But if they are engaging in learning, and if the teacher says, hey, look up this, you know, this topic, and so they're getting information that they can discuss in class, I think that's okay. I think it really depends on the application.
Yeah. Tony, how do you feel about taking phones away at the outset, as some teachers do?
Yeah, I agree with Kristen. I think it really depends on, you know, the teacher, the classroom structure, what you're going to be doing in the classroom that day. You know, I've been to schools where they've literally had lock boxes for the devices and the kids couldn't get them until lunchtime. You know, every school handles that differently. Every classroom teacher handles it differently. I think it's more than appropriate if that's what the teacher feels is the best for whatever class, whatever instruction they have planned for the day.
But generally, that's not your approach, right?
No, I don't usually do that. Again, we manage it as a collective with,
yeah.
with norms and try to just talk a lot about intention and intentionality around the use of the device.
And you feel like conversation directly with the student, your expectations for them, the concerns about distraction, the productive and positive ways to use it, goes over pretty well.
Yeah, we actually do it together as a group. So it's not my decision, it's the group's. And so that way, you know, we put a little bit of the responsibility and the conversation and ideally ownership of what the expectation is on the group versus on me as the sort of, you know, the person responsible for the container that the kids are working in.
Sure, yeah. Dr. Cook, some thoughts there?
Well, what I just heard from Tony is great because I think it's a term that I heard from someone else that I try to use more. It's teaching digital citizenship. I mean, that's really what this is. And maybe someone already brought that up, but kids need to play. Their job, kids, maybe, well, all of us really, play is a great way to learn, and it's their job. And that's how you learn to socially interact. So it's understandable that if they're playing with friends on a game, though it's virtual, not in person, there is a bit of a social interaction there. There's taking turns, there's being fair, but that's, we don't know that is safe or okay in a developing emerging brain. You know, in the first 3 years of life, the amount of neurons that are built in the brain is tremendous. And it's very scary that a small insult of, say, for example, excess screen time in a developing brain of a child less than three could really impact their further learning and capabilities. So what we're doing in the classroom is great, and we have to think along the continuum there. And is it appropriate? The woman who just called who said, you know, have your child a flip phone. I would argue that that's perfect. I look at my kids' phones. I'll check their usage. They almost never use the phone function. You know, there's no minutes burned. There's some texting, but they're in group chats. This is nothing more than a mobile computer. I mean, that's what they're using it for. And so if you want them to have access to anything and everything on the internet, good, bad, and ugly, get them a smartphone. If you just need them to text or call, maybe have a map tracker or something, then get them a flip phone. I mean,
all right. So Tim, Cherise, Lisa, we're going to peel through your phone calls on the other side of this break. So please stay there because there's a lot of feedback coming from a lot of different directions as we talk about the benefits and the possible pitfalls of technology, screen time, how schools are trying to use technology appropriately and effectively. Tony Tepidino is here from Allendale Columbia School, and Kristen Rorpaugh is the president of the Allendale Columbia School Parents Association. Dr. Steve Cook is a professor of pediatrics at Golisano Children's Hospital. Let's go ahead and take that break and your feedback on the other side. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, our first hour is all about the prevailing wage, the debate about who benefits and some of the complaints raised in the business community. We'll discuss prevailing wage first hour. In our second hour, the One Take Film Festival is back for its third year next month. We'll get a preview of this year's lineup and discuss a couple of documentaries, including one about the dangers faced by Afghan refugees seeking asylum.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from RIT's Undergraduate Admissions Office, hosting a spring preview day on Friday, April 12th. For information and reservations, call 475-6631.
A doctor who fled Venezuela 5 years ago now treats other Venezuelans walking hundreds of miles through Colombia.
To see people who can't walk in their shoes anymore and decide to go barefoot, for hours and days in the sun, through rain, through cold, heat.
Following the path of Los Caminantes, Venezuelans leaving their country behind, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tim in Pittsburgh is next. Go ahead, Tim.
Hey, Evan. Just for reference, Evan and I are probably around the same age. We grew up with mostly Nintendo. No way of socializing with our friends while playing it. I mean, that would have been unheard of. And, the schedule, though, I don't think is that much difference. We would go to school. I'm guessing, Evan, I'm just speaking for you, sorry.
Yeah.
We would go to school, go to sports practice, whatever it was, with our friends, come home, and, if you had a girlfriend or something, you might talk to her for a little while on the phone. But after we left our friends, you didn't really socialize with them at night, and it wasn't necessary. We weren't missing out on anything. Now it seems like parents are saying their kids have to be socializing somehow with their friends every waking moment. And I agree with the doctor there that socializing when these kids are on games, my kid does it every once in a while, that is not socialization. What they're talking about is strictly about the game half the time, and it doesn't even make sense. And if that is passing for socialization now, I feel I don't know what's going to happen to these kids. But really, if my kid is not talking to his friends after 8 o'clock at night, I don't give a crap. It's not going to hurt him. And for someone to say, well, they need that to socialize, I think that's an excuse, and or that the kid has conned some parent into saying, well, if I can't, you know, talk with someone while gaming, how am I ever gonna talk to people, or when? How am I gonna know what's going on? I've got three kids. That if my son says that to me, I would just look at him and tell him that that's such a BS thing to say, and he would probably laugh at himself that he even brought it up. That he said, like, he thought he was gonna get that over on someone. So it's just an excuse. That's all it is.
All right, well,
Thanks, Evan.
Well, thank you for the phone call, Tim. Okay. Kristen, you want to take that? You want to respond to that?
You know, yes, they're probably not talking about life topics and, you know, other things going on, but they are interacting. And, you know, they're strategizing together on how they're going to, you know, beat this other opponent. And that's still interacting. That's still socializing, where, you know, I'm okay with him doing that if it's for an hour or two after his homework is done, because otherwise he wouldn't have been interacting with his friends at all. And I think it's okay to interact that way versus not at all. I don't know. That's not my perception.
Okay. Dr. Cook?
I think it's important to understand the balance. What Tim was saying, though, I agree with him 100%. Like, they're not going to be harmed from that. And we have, I mean, let's face it. This world is drastically changing for many reasons, and part of it is out of fear, real or perceived. You know, not just this. And our fear that our kid is missing out on something is why we do what we do.
FOMO is a term that I didn't even know until recently. Fear of missing out.
Exactly. And so I think that's what Tim's pointing out. And I would argue that, you know, are they going to be horribly delayed or scarred or something because of that? No. But we have to monitor. And one of the things we say with parents, we try to say in talking about screen time, is don't just, you know, oh, I know they're only using this. No, see what they're using. You know, watch what they're watching. YouTube, even YouTube Kids, there's filters on it, do not work. Inappropriate material gets through that constantly. And when you point that out to parents, you know, you don't know who's responding to them. You don't know who that person is. It could be anyone, anywhere, with all kinds of intentions. So you just can't assume it's safe. So, and that's part of parenting, monitoring, keeping an eye on kids.
Well, And then there's the question, I'm going to turn to Tony Tepidino for this. You know, a lot of kids will say, but hey, this app or this particular game, et cetera, it's labeled as educational. I mean, and producer Megan Mack pointing out there's, what, 80,000 apps labeled as educational? I mean, I don't know if that has any actual legal meaning or any standard to it. I have no idea. How do you feel about how do we determine, well, it says it's educational, but...
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I don't know who's making those calls. You know, Apple has those tags in the App Store where you can upload as a developer.
Which is very clever for gaming companies.
Yeah,
because then the kid
is.
Can go to the parents, but it's educational.
Right. And, you know, that's, again, I think Dr. Cook's spot on. It's like you just have to be on top of talking to your children, monitoring, and understanding actually what it is that they're doing, because it might say educational, but, you know, what actually is it doing, or what are you doing on there? I think that's just another part of that conversation and monitoring that we have to continue to do in all aspects of the lives of our kids.
I think it's also important to talk to your kids saying, and we have with our children saying, you know, they design these games to be addictive. They design it so you just want to get one more level and another level and another, so it keeps you sucked in. And, you know, we do have conversations with them and say, you need to be aware of that. And go in and say, okay, you've been on enough, you're done, let's go do something else.
I know an 8-year-old, this is not my child, turned 7 today. I know an 8-year-old who recently gave up a gaming system because he felt like he was addicted, and he was able to articulate that at the age of 8.
Wow.
A very powerful moment in that family. But good for him for recognizing. Cherie is on the phone next. Go ahead, Cherie.
Hi, Evan. I was a former teacher with Rochester City Schools, and one of the things that I noticed that in my last years, I had students who were in third grade, and basically they had become conditioned to actually having devices, and coming in and using said device, but not using it in a purposeful way, in the sense of speaking with others or how it could help improve their work. My concern as teachers is that we are always being asked to monitor the data that comes through to show student outcomes and achievement. What has happened now is you have a lot of educational apps and educational games that are placed in the hands with students, and now they're even voice-enabled. My concern is, as they go through, teachers on the back end still have to monitor that piece of it, but also provide critical feedback. And I think it's a conversation that needs to be expanded, not just with parents and students, their children, but also parents and schools, and actually saying, you know, please give us, what is the quantifiable time that my child is spending on a device in grades K to 3? Because that is going to impact their social development in the intermediate grade levels when we really want them getting into those rich conversations and analyzing text about what they've just read or what they've just witnessed through media. And I feel we're losing that. We're losing that a lot. So if the panel could kind of speak to that, about that full 360 partnership that comes around, not with just parents speaking with their children, but also advocating at the district. This is great that we have this digital technology piece. How can we make it more purposeful so that we have all aspects of our child's development accounted for?
Cherise, that's powerful stuff. Thank you for that phone call. I'm going to start with Tony Tepedino from Allendale, Columbia. Go ahead, Tony.
Well, I think what's interesting about that is, you know, we're at an independent school, and so one of the advantages that we have is we really don't have software that's sort of dictated to us that we have to use. We do kind of pervasively use a learning management system, but it's not like there's like this expectation of a number of hours. And, you know, we do use some digital tools to track certain things in our lower school students when it comes to certain, you know, like math or reading, but it's not, it's definitely utilized very differently. And I don't want to speak to how public school systems use these tools because I'm not in them, but my children are. So I do know, you know, that they just did state testing on computers. So, you know, they're staring at screens for a lot of different reasons that we might be utilizing them in an independent school. I think she's right. It's a great conversation that we should be aware of, and we should be, especially as parents, knowing, you know, is my child looking at a screen for 6 hours a day? Because that would be really obviously bad. And then they're coming home and they do need to decompress and they do have homework to do. And screens are usually a part of both of those scenarios in some situations. So I agree 100% that we should have that conversation.
Okay. Dr. Cook?
This is, you know, a hugely important conversation to have. I'm glad this is brought up. I mean, we're seeing on a physical side of this, kids with more headaches, sleep problems, emotional problems, depression. Studies are showing the more time you spend on social media with a down or depressed affect, it will worsen that. You know, sleep is one of the most underutilized medicines we have. We're all suffering from lack of it, and these devices are very much impacting it. So even if they're staring at a screen during school, just answering questions or reading off of it, that the glow of the screen, the LED, the light, is not really good for them. And we have to really be aware of that. And it's habituating them to a certain behavior pattern. And what is not happening? They're not being as active. They're not being using verbal communication as much. So it's really important to be aware of it. So yes, they can have a role, but you know, we have to be able to role model this and not think that it's entirely safe or benign just because, oh, they're just reading a passage from it, or they're, you know, they're watching an informational movie or something on it. Well, if they click onto something else at the same time, have something running in the background, you know, you just don't know.
Kathy in Penfield says, I think the way to change kids' behavior with technology is to alter the way adults are using technology. Kids base their behavior after what they experience in their environment. It's so much easier for adults to assume that kids are responding to peer pressure by using technology excessively, but it's more difficult for adults to assume some of the responsibility for the excessive time spent with the device because it's what they see the adults in their life doing. Yeah. As a parent who's trying to work all the time and be engaged, I've been there, and Kathy, you know, so I have seen the enemy in this case, and sometimes it is me. I think that's a powerful point that we can all model. That's a really, really good one. Liz writes to us and says, as the parent of a student at Allendale Columbia, she loves how the Allendale is helping her child become a better digital citizen. Define that. What's a digital citizen?
Well, we have a curriculum that we teach with our sixth graders, and it trickles down into lower school. And we talk a lot about being we actually use digital. We have a definition for digital literacy, which is basically being able to navigate online spaces, but to do it with thought and with understanding. So, you know, the myth of the digital native, we sort of like debunk that as early as we can. Kids do know how to use the devices, so, but they don't know how to use it like intelligently. You know, they'll just do things. So we talk a lot about, you know, why we're using it, the point of using it. And actually, we say a digitally literate student is able to navigate digital environments with various devices while also evaluating and managing and communicating information efficiently. So that's sort of our take on that. And we have a really simple code of conduct that we use, and it's protect self and others, respect self and others, and respect and protect intellectual property. And those are things that aren't technology specific. They're just human. So we really try to attack it from the perspective of being a human being first, and then there's this thing called technology that's part of that conversation too. So that's kind of how we define that, and really being thoughtful about the ways that we're interacting with each other as human beings, and that it just extends to the digital world.
Kristen is the parent of two teenage boys. What does a digital citizen mean for your kids? What do you hope they become, especially with one student now at Allendale?
I think if they can be taught how to be responsible citizens online, you know, not expressing negative views to other people just because they're hidden behind a screen name. You know, I do like how Allendale Columbia eased the students into using the devices. They started out with an iPad and they were limited with what could be installed on it, what could be done with it. And then in high school, they're given laptops. And I think they also explained well to the students what a social media footprint is. They explained how everything you post is out there and how that can be perceived to other people, employers, later on. You know, if they can realize that, you know, that social media footprint, how important that is, and that it's a good way to just realize how you're seen now and how you're seen in the future. I think, you know, I think that's a really good thing for students to learn, that it's permanent. Even if Snapchat, you know, the image goes away, it really doesn't.
I hope so. Dr. Cook has talked about some of the deleterious health effects, and I do want to squeeze in one more phone call because I know Lisa wants to talk about what's good for the brain, what stimulates the brain. Go ahead, Lisa.
Thank you, Evan. Every day I marvel at the humanity of this show. I just love it. Thank you for what you do here.
Well, thank you.
I was just reminding, in the 60s and 70s, I was a teenage summer aide in a program we got away with then calling remedial reading. Scholarship told them that one thing we really that helped with reading was reading out loud to an adult. The neural connection between the eye, the speech, the oral reception of their own voicing of the text was thought to help. I saw it help in a four-week program, and then in the 80s and 90s, I recommended this to parents despairing about their kids' reading, and they said that it worked for them. That's a performance issue, but, you know, the whole issue of kids as human beings, the human interaction increases empathy. I think we need to remember Mattel first developed the video game for the Pentagon because during the Vietnam War, they realized there was a recurring problem they had detected in World War II, and that was soldiers not firing their weapons at another human being. And I think we need to look at who is trying to migrate us from the human interaction to the digital interaction. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. Thanks for the phone call. Dr. Cook?
Oh, man, that was cold. But, I mean, it is very important. I mean, why is anything developed? Why is anything, you know, new product is brought to market? I mean, there's always lots of reasons, not always good. I mean, I don't know the true history behind Facebook, but I mean, I think we're learning a lot of things about what's happened with that. Something that has come out well-intended, or perhaps well-intended, is now, you know, being manipulated in very deleterious ways in terms of, you know, what's good for the brain. Go outside, talk, communicate, interact, reading on, have a, you know, I have one of my signature lines, an app does not replace a lap. Reading, have a kid on your lap and read to them. That's been repeatedly shown. And what is shown is that also that if you are reading off a device, you don't develop the same communication skills. Playing on a device, you actually learn more of a visual pattern field as opposed to left to right. So kids have trouble reading because more screen use is on a vertical pattern as opposed to reading left to right. And so this is another potential deleterious effect of having these devices. So some things are still good for us.
Reading out loud.
Reading out loud. Go outside, play in the sunshine, run around, get a little dirt on it, you know. It's a good thing.
Yeah, Lisa, thank you. And that's sort of a great closing argument from Dr. Cook. Tony, for you, you know, schools are always going to have choices now. Technology is going to be part of our lives until the next species is looking at the weird remains of our civilization here. So that's it. We have to figure out what we're going to do with it. Give me some closing thoughts from you as to how you make those choices and how you try to bring a philosophy that works.
Well, I think our overall philosophy as a school, it's really about how we engage in the real world. And we're really trying to be overt and thoughtful about how we pick the tools that we're using with our students, the purpose for that, and really getting them to be conscious consumers of whatever it is that they're doing and why. And then trying to teach them that there are repercussions for the decisions that they make and that they really have to deal with that. It's not somebody else's fault or problem. It's theirs. And I really think that's sort of the end game for us as we look at institutionally using technology appropriately.
And Kristen Rohrpaugh, the president of the Allendale Columbia School Parents Association, some final thoughts from you. I know you're a proud parent, and I don't think you'd be here if you weren't happy with not only the education but the approach here.
Correct.
So how do you feel about the way your kids are learning technology and as it relates to school?
I mean, I think our younger son at Allendale is really he's learning real-world situations. He's learning how to balance that. He's trying to balance it at home. He's trying to balance it at school. I think that, you know, by giving the tools from the school of how to do that is very important, that he's learning it in that environment as well, instead of us just saying, off the computer.
Well, thank you for being here. Thanks for sharing your family story. We appreciate your time, Kristen. Tony Tepedino from Allendale, Columbia, thank you as well. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, Evan.
Dr. Steve Cook, who is teaching the lesson of say yes when people call you. Thanks for always saying yes, Dr. Cook.
Yeah, I got to watch that. Thank you.
No, we think it's fabulous. And our thanks to Dolores Parlato, the volunteer helping us out today, and one of the really great people we always see in this building. Thank you, Dolores. Our thanks to Barsook Records and Rah Rah Riot for the music for this program. Rob Braden, the engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a beautiful weekend. We will talk to you Monday on Member Supported Public Radio.